No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, the 14th Amendment. It's been called the single most important amendment to the U.S. Constitution, with wide-ranging applications to civil rights, same-sex marriage, abortion, and other issues. This year marks the 150th anniversary of the 14th Amendment. It was the focus of this year's Constitution Day at the Dole Institute of Politics, held September 18, 2018. This event featured Chief Judge Julie Robinson and Senior Judge John Lungstrom, both of the U.S. District for Kansas, and was moderated by Steve McAllister, U.S. Attorney for the District of Kansas.
I want to go into my constitutional law professor mode for just a couple of minutes. The 14th Amendment is ratified in 1868, obviously follows the Civil War, follows the 13th Amendment a couple years before, which abolishes slavery. But the 13th Amendment alone would not have guaranteed rights. It simply got rid of slavery. So the 14th Amendment is the amendment that is really crucial in many, many ways. And one of the reasons it's crucial is earlier in the 19th century, the Supreme Court had a decision that said the Bill of Rights, so free speech, freedom of religion, search and seizure, all of that, it only applies to the federal government, does not bind the states at all. So the 14th Amendment is going to become the mechanism by which the Supreme Court over time will basically give all of us the Bill of Rights protections against all levels of government. So local, state, and the federal are bound by the Bill of Rights. So the 14th Amendment is important for that reason. One of the reasons the 14th Amendment is also extremely important is the very first sentence. And the very first sentence about all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside, is basically the Constitution overruling the Dred Scott decision, which said that African Americans, their descendants, simply could not be citizens of the United States. So the 14th Amendment, first sentence, takes care of Dred Scott in that respect anyway. Then what you have are three clauses, and this is where it's kind of interesting. The first clause is called the Privileges or Immunities Clause. And all of these provisions you'll see are telling states you cannot deprive people or you must provide something to citizens. So again, this isn't for the federal government. 14th Amendment is directed at state and local governments. And the first clause, the Privileges or Immunities Clause, there's argument about whether that was supposed to be a lot more than it has become. You could argue, wow, the privileges or immunities of U.S. citizenship, that's my right to work, my right to live places, to travel, to go to school, to do all sorts of things. But in 1873, the Supreme Court said, no, it doesn't really mean much. An infamous decision called the Slaughterhouse Cases, they said it's things like you get to vote in federal elections. You can go to the post office. You can use the federal court system. That's not an insignificant one. You can use the seaports of the U.S., but they really limited the Privileges or Immunities Clause very early on, 5 years after the amendment was ratified. The next clause you'll probably be familiar with, the Due Process Clause, which protects deprivations of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. We'll definitely be talking about that one tonight. That's one that from which what you might think of as the privacy and human dignity and those kinds of decisions have often come out of the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment as liberty interests that the court is protecting. And then the final one, we will also be talking about the Equal Protection Clause, which obviously is the basis for Brown versus Board and other cases we'll be talking about. So I do want you to keep that in mind as we go along, and I may refer back to it as we talk, because the 14th Amendment does so much. It's not one clause, it's not one provision, it's not one concept. It's a whole lot of things. And over time has become, in my view, the single most important amendment probably I mean, obviously you needed to get rid of slavery with the 13th Amendment, but in terms of creating rights, the 14th Amendment is the most important amendment and to the Constitution. So with that, I'd like to turn to our panelists, and I'd ask each of you to talk about a 14th Amendment decision by the Supreme Court that you find particularly noteworthy, important, interesting. Just kind of talk about the case and what it means, and even perhaps, you know, what it means today.
Well, I'll start. The 14th Amendment has been referred to as the Great Amendment, and I think the most significant case has been the Brown versus Board decision case, which was a case that was decided under the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, and it's been referred to as the case of the century. Others have referred to it as the case that really was the launching pad for many more civil rights acts and litigation and decisions as well that provided for equal protection of the law in a variety of other contexts outside of public education. But of course, the Brown versus Board case decided that the 14th Amendment, the Equal Protection Clause, meant that African American children were entitled not only to a public education, but to an integrated public education, a public education sitting side by side other American children. And, you know, there's so many stories that can be told about why it's so significant, but it really, I think, was the product of years and years of strategy by a very bright group of lawyers, primarily African-American lawyers, one of whom became the first African-American Supreme Court Justice, Thurgood Marshall, who was appointed to the Supreme Court in 1967, who decided that in light of Plessy versus Ferguson, which was the case that the Supreme Court said separate but equal ensures equal protection under the law, in light of the language of Plessy versus Ferguson, they decided their strategy in part was to focus on that language and to go about proving that separate facilities in public education were not equal. They weren't equal in a tangible way in terms of the money that was spent, the teachers, the resources, the curriculum, but they also were not equal in an intangible way, because education is not only about things that you can buy and things that you can pay for, but education is about the experience and the opportunity to fellowship with people that may be a little bit different than you, and to learn from one another and to sit by one another and to feel like you are fully included in society. So Thurgood Marshall and others, you know, I read about Thurgood Marshall. He traveled more than 50,000 miles a year for very little pay, and he was just one of many that devoted their lives really to this. That culminated in the decision, the 1954 decision that we know as Brown versus Board. You know, and of course we all have a great affinity for the case because it, you know, the lead case, it was five cases, of course, that came before the Supreme Court and were argued together, but the lead case was out of Topeka, Kansas. 13 plaintiffs with 20 children that were in the Topeka public schools. There were actually almost 200 plaintiffs across the other states that were involved in the litigation. But, you know, that was the lead case. I think that forevermore is something that we can be proud of as Kansans, that we had parents that were brave and were willing to fight this fight, and it was a long fight. So I think that is one of the most, if not the most significant 14th Amendment case, because education is such a fundamental right. It is so core to our ability to operate—it's so core to our having liberty in this country. So, it began with that, at least in terms of public education in the lower schools. There had already been test cases and successful cases actually in higher education, but that case, Brown versus Board, then launched us into so much more in terms of equal protection in public accommodation, housing, transportation, ultimately employment, and all of that.
That's Chief Judge Julie Robinson of the U.S. District Court for the District of Kansas. She spoke at the Dole Institute of Politics annual Constitution Day event. This year's marking the 150th anniversary of the 14th Amendment. And now, Senior Judge John Lungstrom of the U.S. District Court.
Obviously, it's hard to come up with something that would top Brown as far as being the most memorable and important 14th Amendment case. But there are a lot of cases that we all know something about, but don't necessarily relate to the 14th Amendment. Roe versus Wade, Bush versus Gore, Obergefell versus Hodges, the same-sex marriage case. All of these cases would not have been able to be decided on those subjects of abortion, ending an election, or allowing people of the same sex to get married, but for the 14th Amendment, allowing the federal courts to make rulings about things the states were doing. But I'm going to take a more, perhaps, prosaic subject, although I think it's really important, and that's voting rights. In a series of cases in the 1960s, the seminal case for our purposes really being Reynolds versus Sims, the Supreme Court said that the idea of one person, one vote was something which had to be honored at the state level as well as in another case at the federal level under the Constitution itself. Before that time, state legislatures had been many instances incredibly malapportioned. The usual situation was years would go by, population might change, rural folks moving to urban areas, but those rural districts continuing to have the same number of representatives. And so the whole election process got weighted towards particularly rural interests vis-a-vis where the population was then living in the states. And with Reynolds versus Sims, the point was made that there is an equal protection interest there, that your vote and my vote ought to be worth the same, whether we live in a rural area or an urban area or wherever we might happen to live. And that has had a profound impact on the ability of Americans to influence the way in which their state and local governments really carry out their activities. I've had cases on that level, including one in the 1993 called Helbus versus Brownback, in which I found, and the 10th Circuit agreed I was right, which is nice when they do that, that the way in which the Kansas State Board of Agriculture was constituted was unconstitutional because it was elected by people from farm organizations primarily. Yet it had general governmental powers. It regulated the amount of pesticides you could put on your lawn at home, regulated the way gas pumps would work at the gas station. It wasn't just an agricultural promotion organization. Yet since 1917, Kansas had never changed the way it elected this board that had this general governmental power, and basically it was a very small electorate that did so. I found that that violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. It violated the principles of one person, one vote, or Reynolds versus Sims. And in more recent times, the Kansas legislature, after the last census, didn't get around to reapportioning, and that left it in the laps of three of us on the federal court to decide how to do all of that, but we were guided by the one person, one vote principle of Reynolds versus Sims with regard to the state legislative districts, as well as the other cases with regard to the federal election districts. So there are real issues that we have to deal with in our courts that, as I say, are a little more prosaic than Brown, but I think are something that are extremely important for us all as citizens.
Well, in those cases, one person, one vote still come up in various forms today. And I will say, before I turn the next question, one of the justices I was fortunate to work for was Justice Byron White. And he served from about 1962 until 93. And when he visited the law school, one of our students asked him, what do you think was the most important decision or line of decisions in your time as a justice on the Supreme Court? And he actually said the one person, one vote cases he thought in terms of the practical effect they had were extremely significant. So we can always come back to some more historical perspective, but I'm also curious what you might want to share with the audience about your modern experience, if you will. I mean, we're talking about cases that are 50, 60 years old, and once we bring in Dred Scott and the slaughterhouse and civil rights, we've gone back a long ways, but what about the kind of cases the two of you see that really flow from 14th Amendment principles, 14th Amendment doctrines? Is it still relevant and important today?
Well, I would have to say that a pretty significant share of the federal district court caseload is comprised of cases that are brought under Title 28 United States Code Section 1983, a civil rights statute, that people sue county and local governments and entities associated with that. for deprivation of constitutional rights under the 14th Amendment. So, you know, if you call those 14th Amendment cases, and they are, I don't know what percentage, but they make up a pretty significant percentage of our civil caseload. So, I mean, we can give you lots of examples, but one that comes to mind are, you know, cases that are brought against police departments for excessive force or false arrest or against the county for malicious prosecution. There are lots of those cases across the federal government, and those are based on the 14th Amendment applying the 4th Amendment, which says that you have a right to not be subjected to unreasonable searches and seizures. And so these are, you know, based on perhaps unreasonable seizures of a person when they're taken into custody or their liberty in some way has been restricted in the course of some interaction with law enforcement. We get a fair number of those cases. And then we get a number of cases, I think, that are brought under the due process clause of the amendment. Procedural due process and substantive due process cases. Procedural due processes for process cases, for example, if someone says that they had a property interest that was terminated in some way by a subdivision of the state without a procedural due process. They didn't receive notice and an opportunity to be heard by a neutral decision maker, you know, one of those things or perhaps all of them. So we get a fair number of those cases. We get cases that are brought against school boards often based on the procedural due process provisions of the 5th Amendment. What else? There's so many.
right. No, you've covered the waterfront very well. You also sometimes see them in a slightly unusual context. A case will wind up in your lap. For example, I had a case brought by some parents in the Johnson County School District who argued that the local option budget cap was unconstitutional, both violating due process and equal protection under the 14th Amendment. The idea being that the School Finance Act basically said that there's a limit to how much local governmental units can spend to augment the state allocations. And these parents thought that violated their constitutional rights to not be able to spend more. And they basically felt they had a right to compel an election to impose an additional tax. So that case, which involves a little bit unusual set of facts, wouldn't have wound up in federal court were not for those prongs of the 14th Amendment.
Chief, you mentioned procedural and substantive due process. Maybe the two of you could tease that out a bit with a little more explanation and some examples. I mean, this is a sense, there's only one due process clause, but the understanding as it's come to be through court interpretation is they're kind of two different tracks for due process claims. And so you want to just kind of talk about the difference and if you have examples from your experience or anything that you might want to share.
Well, procedural due process really focuses on did a person receive a fair process? What the clause says is you shall not be deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So if someone, for example, is deprived of a property right, they have a right to have a fair process, meaning an opportunity to be heard, which sort of subsumes that they have to have a notice that they have an opportunity to be heard and that the issue itself will be decided by a neutral decision maker. So there are a number of cases that are brought under that provision. Substantive due process, and of course the due process clause doesn't say anything about procedure or substance, but it has, the courts have interpreted these two tracks. So substantive due process is based on the notion that, particularly when we talk about liberty, that there are rights that are so fundamental to our liberty that this clause protects them. And so Supreme Court jurisprudence has been that such rights as the right to marry, and in the Obergefell case, the right to marry not only someone of an opposite sex, but someone of the same sex, but the right to marry, the right to have children, that there's...
Roe versus Wade.
Roe versus Wade.
Those are...
Exactly. The right to procreate, the right to have an abortion, All of these have, the focus has been that that's a fundamental right. That, you know, the language around, I think, substantive due process often talks about autonomy and intimacy, intimate rights, and, you know, decisions that are so personal to you and so important to you that the government should not deprive of you, you know, irrespective of process, the government should not deprive you of that right.
And here's where those cases get really interesting, as Steve knows better than we do, since he's had that intimate involvement with the court and how they've tried to deal that at the highest level. But the first step they have to decide is there a fundamental right? Once they decide there's a fundamental right, then the mechanism of the 14th Amendment provides a basis to have that your protection of being able to exercise that right. So it's not so much a 14th Amendment analysis, because that kind of just falls into place. But the question is there a fundamental right to do a certain kind of thing or not to have a certain kind of thing happen to you, and whatever the situation might happen to be. So it's a little more complicated than just what you would look at this piece of paper and think it might turn out to be.
Well, and there's, you know, there's obviously varying views about this. And if you read most of the cases, the Supreme Court cases that talk about substantive due process, there's very different views about whether something was a fundamental right and whether it was a fundamental right that was contemplated by the drafters of the 14th Amendment at the time they drafted. It was ratified in 1868, so it was, you know, it was drafted in the 1860s. So it took a couple of years. So, the originalists, if you will, try to go back and say, is this something that they contemplated? What was the state of the law at that time? Was this something they had in mind when they drafted this language about not being deprived of liberty or not?
Well, and sometimes, obviously, that will not justify a decision in favor of rights. So the Obergefell is a good example. I mean, if you look at same-sex marriage, and the question is, well, was that something society recognized 150 years ago? The answer is pretty clear. So there's kind of one line of tend to ask those questions. Was this really firmly rooted, well-established, sort of known to the common law, as they would call it, so we should recognize it as something embraced by the Constitution? But another view is that why are we going to limit ourselves to what was going on 150 or 200 years ago? Societies evolve. We better appreciate over time sometimes how important something is to people. And so the importance of the interest really ought to be a dominant factor in whether we recognize this or not. But you will see that tension constantly between the justices on the Supreme Court in these high-profile cases.
And that's primarily the difference between the so-called conservative justices and the so-called liberal justices. All of them would agree that once you decide there's a fundamental right, the 14th Amendment gives protection. But determining whether there is such a right and how you go about determining it is where the debate really comes together.
That's Senior Judge John Lungstrom and Chief Judge Julie Robinson, both of the U.S. District Court for the District of Kansas. If you're just joining us today on KPR Presents, we're marking the 150th anniversary of the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It's the annual Constitution Day program at the Dole Institute of Politics at the University of Kansas. This event was moderated by Steve McAllister, U.S. Attorney for the District of Kansas, and was recorded on September 18, 2018. I'm Kay McIntyre. You're listening to KPR Presents on Kansas Public Radio.
As I think is probably apparent from what we've said so far, much of the law, really, is judge-made. I mean, it is a matter of what, starting with really from the Supreme Court and then those of us out here in the field having to try to figure out what those people really mean, are the ones who actually are giving some contours to what the 14th Amendment means. There are statutes like Section 1983, which provide a vehicle for enforcing these rights. When it really comes right down to it, what are those rights are largely determined by judges making those decisions. As district judges, trial judges like Julie and I are, we're at the very bottom of that particular process. We very rarely are out there causing too much trouble, I don't think. Well, maybe so. maybe so. But the point is, the way our system works, we have this tradition of common law, in which judges try to figure out what the rules of the road ought to be, based upon precedent, and based upon what maybe changing times might happen to bring to it, and so forth. And so those 9 Supreme Court justices ultimately are the ones who have to look at this language, which is pretty bare bones, and then say, how does that apply to having an abortion? How does that apply to who I can marry? How does that apply to how I have my schools set up or my election process? They have to decide that. Our task as district judges, I think, is to try to figure out what they've said those rules are and to try to apply those faithfully. And that's not always easy. As I told Steve earlier, the only reason I agree to be on this panel is I want Steve to apply, tell us about community, because that's the most difficult area of this whole subject matter. That's the task that people like Julie and I have, is to try to figure out what it is that the Supreme Court has told us those rules are going to be and how they would apply under the facts of a given situation. The hardest part about that is that you have real people there now. It's not just a debating point. It isn't just originalism versus living constitution. I mean, it is Joe and Tom and Billy and Mary and Sally and so on and so forth, and they have real concerns and real issues, and we're left in the first instance trying to figure out how all these rules apply to affect their real life problems. So that's the challenging part.
I will say this, though, just in terms of focusing on the part of your question that talked about enforcement. You know, so the Supreme Court, you know, announces a rule that, you know, has great breadth. We have to ultimately figure out how it applies to the situations presented to us in real cases and controversies as they are individually presented to us. But the judicial branch has no enforcement power. We don't have our own, cadre of police that go out and make sure that our rules are, our orders are enforced. And so we rely on the fact that the public, that our American fellow Americans recognize the rule of law and the force of that, and that we're governed by that. Even if we disagree with a particular rule of law, it is the rule of law. And so we really rely, I guess, on the American spirit and the American culture to understand, and largely it does, that that's the way our system operates, that we have a political voice through our votes and in other ways in terms of laws that are legislated. But there's this whole other body of law that's common law, that is judge-made law, and that there's a recognition that that has equal force too, and that is something that we all have to live with and abide by.
So one thing I hear you telling us is you can't just pick up the Constitution and read it for a moment and have an answer to the case.
I think you can.
Then we'll see if we agree with you or not.
Right. Yeah. And at the end of the day, we know whose opinion matters. So, so maybe just to follow up, you kind of touched on this, Judge Lungstrom, but maybe both of you, it might be good for the audience to hear, because there's a lot of stuff in the media anymore, and Supreme Court confirmations, as we've seen, become these huge political battles. Is there law here, or are these cases just a judge saying, well, I'd really like to see it come out this way, and that's how I'm going to decide it? So.
You know, I think one thing that gets lost in the messaging is the fact that a great percentage of Supreme Court decisions are unanimous. I think is it 40%? That number sticks in my mind, and it may change from year to year. But, you know, the cases that get talked about primarily are the cases where there's dissension and disagreement, and, you know, substantive due process is one of those areas where there's that kind of thing, and so people get the sense that it's just, you know, 9 judges and, you know, just that disagree and they're just doing their own thing and that they're not paying attention to the law. And, you know, I think you hopefully have a sense tonight that, again, we're talking a bare-bones constitution, and if you're someone that really wants to focus on what did the drafters of the 14th Amendment have in mind, that's a very difficult analysis. It's always a difficult analysis, as Judge Lundstrom said, to figure out, is it a fundamental right or not? And, you know, people look at these things differently, but they're not deciding them on the basis of their ideology. They're deciding them on the basis of this whole body of precedential law. And, you know, they're really doing, all of them are really doing their best to try to interpret that law in light of what their understanding is of what the Constitution says and what it was meant to say.
What I would add to that is this. I have been now a federal judge since 1991. That's almost, 27 years. I have never heard a federal judge say, well, I was appointed by a Republican or I was appointed by a Democrat, so I'm going to rule this way or that way. I mean, there's no partisan angle to it. What is, however, clear is what your legal philosophy may be. And just like we all have different ideas about all sorts of things in life, there can be a good faith difference between somebody who believes that the way to interpret the constitutional is to try to figure out what the drafters meant, and those who say that's hamstringing ourselves, we need to be able to grow with the times. That's a very consequential difference. That's a very consequential argument. It's the difference between 5 votes and 4, quite often, on the Supreme Court, because they have a different philosophy about how to solve that problem. And it's not because they want to do honor to President so-and-so or President such-and-such, but because they have a good faith, different view about how one ought to solve that problem. And that's kind of what it boils down to. And you can kind of predict if someone espouses a particular point of view, where he or she may fall on those kinds of controversial decisions, but not necessarily because of their partisan stripe or who appointed them, but rather what that philosophy is.
You know, and I will say at the trial level, because we are deciding cases on the basis of precedent that is authoritative, we have to follow. In the District of Kansas, we have to follow the rulings of the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. And, of course, we all have to follow the rulings of the Supreme Court. I would venture to say, and there are 6 active district judges and, 4 senior judges, and we've been appointed by everyone through, from, I think, Gerald Ford, or Reagan, at least.
Reagan
through Trump on our court. And if you were to read our decisions, if you were to lay them out, let's just say on the same case, if we all wrote a decision on the same case, I would say in probably more than 95% of those cases, you couldn't say, oh, that's Robinson writing that, or that's Lundstrom. I mean, I don't think probably you could ever do it, actually, because it's going to be very much the same. We're doing our best to apply the precedent, the authority that we have to follow, and we may write it a little differently. Some of the analysis may be different, but by and large, the decision's going to be the same.
Yeah, she puts her footnotes at the end. I do mine in the opinion. You can tell them the difference there.
But mine's better. My method is better.
Well, I like mine better.
With that, I'm going to say thank you so very much. What a wonderful crowd tonight.
You've just heard the Dole Institute of Politics Constitution Day program featuring Chief Judge Julie Robinson and Senior Judge John Lundstrom, both of the U.S. District for Kansas, and Steve McAllister, U.S. Attorney for the District of Kansas. This event marked the 150th anniversary of the 14th Amendment and was the 13th annual Constitution Day program at the Dole Institute. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.